This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Cameron Pierce. He is a writer. Cameron, it is great having you on.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on.
And I'm also joined here with my co-host, Pilliter.
It's nice to be on, Robert. I'm actually quite a fan of your work, Cameron.
Oh, thanks. Appreciate that.
Cameron, can you tell us about yourself, kind of your life story, how you got started out, and what kind of inspired you to get into writing?
Yeah, I'd love to. So I've been writing mostly bizarro fiction for a little over, it's about a decade now. I had my first stories published in some of the journals in the bizarro scene when I was in high school. And when I was 18, Eraserhead Press signed me to a 5-book contract. The year after my first book, Shark Hunting in Paradise Garden, came out, I dropped out of college, moved to Portland, and started working in the Eraserhead Press offices. And I was doing that full time.
So you lived in California most of your life?
Yeah, California, then Washington, and now Oregon.
That's interesting because when I first started reading you, I was in a community college, and the book I had was Ask Goblins for Auschwitz, and I thought it was the most absurdest thing I've read. That at that time I was also in a creative writing fiction class, and I was also really into splatterpunk or like Edward Lee. I had a brain cheese buffet. It's like this one. Have you read that one before?
Yeah, I have. That's a good one.
Yeah, it's very like just absurd to the top and just this really strange. And I was experimenting at that time, and I remember in community college I wrote this I guess proto bizarro fiction story at that time. I was a teenager, and it was called a Nana Song. It was basically this strange Natalie Portman as an android and my favorite anime character from this show, Slam Dunk. And basically, Natalie Portman android sings this strange song with all these songs I like where I cut up the lyrics and I put it together in this strange cut-up bro style. And I remember trying to
present... Did you make this into a video or just a story?
No, it's just a story. It was I actually posted it on my blog, but... when I played it that, everyone in class thought it was strange-o, and I don't know, I felt bad for it, but at the same time, I kind of felt, well, I was only expressing, and I think Cameron's work has something to do with that, and my exposure to bizarro fiction on that.
That's funny. Yeah.
Do you get, like, any flack for Ask Goblins and Auschwitz, because for the obvious theme?
You know, shockingly, as widely as that book has been spread around, I think I've received very few threats or anything of that nature, which still surprises me. It's, you know, it's almost, the response is almost all positive, and I'm not really sure how that happened because it is so flagrantly offensive. I'd expect a little bit of that, but it just, you know, it's mostly positive responses, strangely.
When you wrote that, were you thinking of like trying to come up with something like extremely offensive, or more just kind of exploring like a surreal kind of a nightmare theme?
Yeah, so at the first ever BizarroCon, the 9th BizarroCon just happened in Portland last week. But at the first one, there was a workshop where you could basically pitch a book to one of the Eraserhead editors and develop the concept. And I came up with Ask Goblins of Auschwitz for it. Shortly after that, they asked if I wanted that to be my second book. And at the time, I didn't think I could write something called Ask Goblins of Auschwitz. You know, I thought I could use the title, but maybe it'd be a 3-novella collection, but have nothing to do with that title, just because it was almost too over the top. And over time, it kind of became apparent that I absolutely had to write Ask Goblins. So I didn't set out intending to do so necessarily, and tried to avoid doing it, but I'm definitely glad I did.
And this doesn't take place in actual, like, that era in history. It actually takes place in the future. It's also like a sci-fi.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think totally reality.
I think it's funny because I had a science fiction class too at the time, and I really liked, you know, like William Gibson, the whole cyberpunk and Neuromancer. And I always think it's interesting that during that, you know, old school time of Isaac Asimov in the 50s, all of a sudden, you know, you had new wave like Harlan Ellison and his I Have No Mouth, I Must Scream. and kind of went into that very strange, like, psychedelic thing, you know, like Philip K. Dick and Samuel R. Delaney, and all of a sudden, you know, this is kind of well talked about now, all of a sudden after the post-cyberpunk, it kind of got, I'll use the term, like, social justice warrior kind of type of writing, but now I think it's kind of strange because with the whole, you know, bizarro fiction and ass goblins from Auschwitz, it sounds quite like shock art or some kind of reflection on that, where it's like, is there some kind of resistance between that people have got so bored with sci-fi that it's no longer about going in the future and now it's just writing what you feel like or having lucid dreaming and going all the way back to maybe like Lovecraft dream journaling or something?
Yeah, I think bizarro is an interesting movement because, I mean, on one hand, it's pretty distinctly American that there are strains of weird fiction in all cultures, but a lot of the tropes and stories in bizarro are you know, basically American stories, and part of that is I think this fixation on other genres, but like always having like one foot in them. So, you know, bizarro stories are partially science fictional. You know, horror is definitely an influence, even a bit of fantasy, but none of it's done faithfully.
I mean, were you a fan of Weekly World News?
I was, I loved it.
Yes. Because I that's what I got from it. Like the paranormal gossip strips where it's just that same cut and paste style where you can just say like, I can't even explain, you know, a UFO or something like that, and add in maybe with some kind of Ren and Stimpy comical humor, and then you get Bizarro, and that's
it's a strong influence from like underground films. Definitely, you know, well, we don't really have video stores anymore, but the cult section of Video Store is how we used to describe Bizarro, and you know, earlier movements like Surrealism and Dadaism, but more infused with narrative and a little bit less experimental.
That's funny because I was going to thinking about like VHS tapes, you know, like there's this whole like culture or kind of consumer market now online where you ever see a, like there's this guy, this French guy, he has a Tumblr called StanVHS.tumblr, and he does like Game of Thrones on VHS tape, where he'll get like Wolf on Wall Street. It looks like it's from like mid 80 or something, and then people will go to like conventions and sell these VHS tapes for like $50, and it looks like a relic of the past, but it's made today. Awesome. Yeah, and I think that there is this really cool now VHS culture happening. I was because when I look at some of the art and all your books, it does have this reflection, like it's some pulp was published in 60, but it's today. You find it in the most dark, offensive corner of some strange library, and it's people are falling in love with the aesthetic nature of it. Or, like, if you think about it, like, there's this one VHS tape I like. It's called Peppermint Park. Have you ever heard of it? It's this. It's this strange children's direct show. Like, you would buy this at like some dollar store, and it's a notoriously bad and strange children's programming. It only had like few VHS tapes, but people go after it, and like shows like Wonder Shoujin, which was like 10 years ago, was influenced by Peppermint Park as this kind of it's funny because it's like there's this cool falling between the aesthetic of something you found and compared to what we were talking about previously, like vaporwave, where vaporwave is simply a genre of music where you're representing mall music or some kind of strange nostalgic aesthetics. I mean, is there that kind of aesthetics that you find in bizarro fiction?
I think with some of the writers, absolutely. And that reminds me most of probably Gary Arthur Brown, newer bizarro author who's doing some really interesting, absurdist short fiction. So I think you see some of that. Carlton Mellick, in more recent works, has done a little bit of that. But yeah, this one.
Oh, Carlton Mellick is the one, he did The Haunted Vagina.
Exactly, yeah, The Haunted Vagina.
It's funny because I know there's very other similar artists too that I like. I think it's also on Lazy Fascist Press, like Sam Pink and Gary J. Shipley, which is very interesting, where it's more based upon like as art, where it's like it's a mix between that punk scene, but also like this is a book that's so unique that you have it in your possession. But I also would say, are you in a Portland, right?
No, I moved out to the coast. I'm out in Astoria, Oregon now.
Okay. Have you ever seen Portlandia?
Yeah.
Okay. And, you know, I always feel like is there some kind of Portlandia culture going on with some of the scene? Is it exclusively Portland?
To a large degree, I mean, it's not exclusively Portland at all. But a lot of our authors have been attracted to live in Portland for a while. It's a smaller city. You know, it's also cheaper than New York, Los Angeles, or San Francisco. The weather's pretty mild, and it's a place that just nurtures weird culture. So it's definitely been a hotbed for Bizarro for a number of years, and I think a lot of authors in the scene have lived there at some point or another. But at this point, you have just as many Bizarro authors in Chicago or Texas or on the East Coast.
I'm here in Philadelphia, and it's a pretty evil and dark city. It's not something other than cheesesteaks and Liberty Bell. It's a interesting place, but I don't know. Yeah,
it's interesting you mentioned Astoria, because I know actually a lot of horror films have been filmed there. I think one of the Ring films was filmed in Astoria.
Yeah, The Ring 2 was filmed here. It's basically a weird little fishing town with a number of breweries. It pretty much rains all the time. It's a fun place with a unique culture.
That's it's funny because you mentioned Ring, because once again with the whole VH. Yeah, because that's funny because you have that and the Blair Witch as being recent. Like, if there was any mainstream interest in theaters with the Americanization of like Blair Witch Project, it's like it could be made with such a low budget. It's on VHS as if it was lost film. Kind of with the whole creepypasta thing. Do you know about the whole creepypasta? If that's something on you.
And there's a creepypasta inspired show, Channel Zero, that's on right now on Sci-Fi Channel. I think
someone also said, I mean, this was kind of a critical comment, but it's kind of fascinating. Someone said that you have all these people growing up watching shows on Nickelodeon, like Ren and Stimpy and Rocko's Modern Life. And then they become adults, and they kind of take that and push it into something darker. And I can kind of see some similarities in the aesthetic. But, I mean, that was a kind of a critical comment, but I can sort of relate to that because, like, I grew up watching those shows.
Yeah. Speaking of cartoons, I mean, why it makes me think of Ren and Stimpy so much is just reading from Ash Goblins of Auschwitz. I think I'm not saying from her exact quotation, but I think it was like the pimply feet is really disgusting looking. I don't know. There's more detail. I know Edward Lee does this where there's extreme detail on like one of his short stories is like you talk about the phlegm liquor when someone snots on the floor and then he eats boogers. And then, the psychologist actually is a booger collector too, and it's like gross out, like, bleh. And it's like Ren and Stimpy did the same thing. It makes me think, you know, in those terms, the old-fashioned '90s cartoons. There's some freak out or just pushing the limits of making you feel uncomfortable or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Were there any films that have influenced you? Well, there's obviously, I mean, there's horror films, but there's also kind of surreal filmmakers like David Lynch.
Yeah, you know, I really love everything from Harmony Korine, Mr. Lonely, Gummo.
Trash Humpers?
Yeah, Trash Humpers.
We were just talking about that on a previous show. Yeah, we were just talking about the interesting...
Oh, yeah, Alex brought up... which show was that?
The Sallow. Do you ever watch Sallow?
Oddly, no, I have not watched that. I don't know. I've read Desaad, seen other films that are loosely based on his work, but for some reason I have not watched that one. Harmony Korine.
No, it's so funny because it's like Trash Humpers is definitely this kind of, you don't know whether it's horror or just some avant-garde film. When I saw it, I was 18 when I first saw it in a theater, and I got a horror feel from it rather than the previous films where Julian Donkey Boy was simply just kind of artistic. And, you know, I always felt there was this kind of strange distance where, you know, Larry Clark's Kids was kind of moralist and kind of almost serious. But then Harmony Korine goes in the direction of where it's its own genre and its own. And you have these old mass people going, make it, don't fake it. And they're just putting soap in pancakes and eating it.
Huh.
I don't know. I always find that funny, and but scary at the same time.
Well, Dan Harmony, Kareen, he wrote the film Kids.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, because Larry Clark's film, we were talking previously, would be more about, you know, pornographic nature. His book Tulsa, about pictures of, you know, like heroin addicts. And but unlike Kareen, he's more experimenting with the absurdity, where it's like Samuel Beckett or something.
Yeah, and that's Harmony Korine's next film will be an adaptation of Alyssa Nutting's novel Tampa. So I think that's going to continue with that sort of horror vibe for you know, something that's not necessarily horror, but that's a feeling that's definitely like evoked in that novel, which I think it's going to be a perfect match for Harmony Korine to direct.
Pilliter, would you say that my book would be a bizarro fiction?
It's funny because me and Robert, we're kind of editing this one book, and Robert's writing this strange vaporwave James Joyce novel about
want to give away the plot, but you can talk about it kind of broadly.
It's a mix of everything from your work to what we mentioned from maybe Peter Sotos, this kind of strange avant-garde long book where we have the whole plot lined out, and it's strange because it's kind of, we take internet memes and make it real and serious, and kind of like, it's almost like it could be passed as American literature, but at the same time it has the absurdity of this postmodern strangeness. But I think it works real well. But
awesome.
If Robert, you wanted to talk more about it, but
yeah, I mean, I don't want to give away too much, but it is really absurdist. A lot of parodies of different.
Can I say like the main character's name?
Writers, and I don't know if you want to give his name because I have a name set out, but because of, like I haven't, it's not like set in stone. Like
okay,
I haven't decided.
We don't want any spoilers on that. It seems like other than that, it seems like comic books or even like the term, like, you know, you have graphic novels where it just seems to be that pictures and comics have a very influence on the person rather than if you were to read something. Like you say, if somebody draws like a dog jumping, getting a frisbee, compared to somebody writes the dog jumps and gets the frisbee, it's more effective when somebody draws it. It seems to me, and like what Bizarro Fiction is really trying to do is like putting art as a fontist thing where the text itself becomes rather a picture. And it's almost like, I don't mean to say it's for the illiterate, but it seems to me that it helps you read, and that Bizarro Fiction might be saving the book industry. Because I think, I'm going on a tangent here, but like the book industry I think is almost dead. It's like you have Barnes and Nobles going out, you know, because it's hard to sell books and it's expensive. Why would you pay like $20 for a book for like a, when you could just get it at like the, you know, like some Impact and get it for like a dime or 25 cents, which I do. And it seems to me that to buy a book now is to buy it to keep it in possession in case there's like some apocalypse, berserk fallout the next day, and you have this book in the kind of under your, you know, you have a physical possession of it and you can read it aloud or at least have a copy of a book. And like when you have new fiction, it seems like in Bizarro Fiction where you have the most colorful, most pretty looking strange book, you can show art to your other friends. And it seems to me that there's a lot of consumption with Bizarro Fiction, how pretty it is, kind of like comic books and graphic novels. Would you say that or?
Yeah, I think to a certain degree, that's definitely true. I mean, a lot of Bizarro readers weren't necessarily dedicated readers until they found Bizarro. But you do get, you know, misfits from every circle of fiction out there who also find it and realize that they didn't fit in because there's this whole other thing and there is a group they belong to. In terms of reading habits, like a lot of the Bizarro books are shorter. Novella length works really well for Bizarro Fiction. Basically, full length novels you don't, you know, see as often. Although in the last couple of years there have been some really good epic Bizarro novels, but the shorter length the influence of cult film, I think, results in a very unique type of fiction that is consumed a little bit differently. So, you know, often you can read most Bizarro books in the time it takes to watch a film, even if you're not necessarily a fast reader. I think that helps. So it's, It is consumed a little bit differently, though, than a lot of genre fiction. What I found from the horror fiction I've written is that a lot of horror readers, for example, they'll read 20 or 30 or 40 of the same sort of book. You know, they might read 20 aquatic horror novels in a month and basically just burn through one after the other. Whereas Bizarre Work, I think due to the nature people are odd, unexpected ways, which reflects the nature of the work being odd and unexpected.
So you have this book, Abortion Arcade, which is a collection of three novellas. Can you for talk about the sort of image on the cover? Where did you get the inspiration for that creature? It's like a zombie, and it's like crawling through this field of flowers. It's very surreal.
Yeah, that image, that's a painting by Hawk Vaught, who has gone on to do dozens of Bizarro book covers. That was the first cover he did for Eraserhead Press, and I was just searching around online for surreal paintings and discovered Hawk's work, and Eraserhead secured permission to use that image for the cover of the collection. I just wanted something that really reflected the tone of the book, not necessarily an image from the book. And I was really, really fortunate to find Hawk, just because he's an amazing artist and he's really done a lot for Bizarro.
Who designed the cover for Ask Goblins from Auschwitz?
That painting was by Samuel Dietz, who did a lot of the most popular Bizarro book covers. He is the cover artist for Ask Goblins, Shatner Quake, Rampaging Fuckers of Everything on the Crazy Shitting Planet of the Vomit Atmosphere by Michael Hansen. Samuel did a lot of really great Bizarro covers as well.
It's funny because I think to myself, will ever Bizarro fiction be like institutionalized? If all this is going on right now, and all these, you know, artists are putting all this to make these artworks, it seems like, well, 20 years on the line, maybe one day Bizarro fiction will be like recorded in academic textbooks. Like, is that will be possible? Is that kind of a...
It's funny. We joke around about that sometimes, but I mean, a lot of Bizarro stories are being taught in universities. And last year I was the writer in residence at Rhodes University in Grahamstown, South Africa. And, they were already using the best Bizarro fiction of the decade anthology, in the graduate program there. I gave a lecture on Bizarro, definitely went and worked on, like, did a lot of work surrounding Bizarro there. And and that's just one example of a lot of Bizarro stuff creeping into classrooms, which is really awesome to see. And I think for students, often a little bit freeing that, it's fiction without boundaries, without rules. Whatever mode of fiction you work in, I think that can be helpful sometimes, just to kind of break you out of some of the constraints that that you can easily impose on yourself when writing.
Can you talk about Die You Donut, Die You Donut Bastards?
Yeah, that originated as a book that I was writing exclusively at Voodoo Donut in Portland. And then one night they told me I couldn't stay there overnight, so I had to go home. That's a story, basically typical zombie apocalypse story, except that the zombies are donuts. It's the title story in a collection of some of my most surreal, but also most personal Bizarro stories.
I see the kind of a Zorro fiction genre on a lot of animated comedy series and Adult Swims. Like, could you make the case that like a show like Super Jail is Bizarro fiction?
I mean, yeah, that's Super Jail, I think, is that's an amazing show and definitely an influence on me and influence on a number of Bizarro writers. So I think in terms of contemporary media, there's a lot of underground independent literature that Bizarro writers are reading and consuming. And then there's a lot of really amazing shows right now, especially some great animated shows like Super Jail.
What about a Pig, Goat, Banana, Cricket? Have you seen that? It's by Dave Cooper. Dave Cooper is like a lowbrow artist, and it's funny because it is weird. And
Yeah, I'll have to check that out. That and Xavier Renegade Angel. That's a fun one.
It's funny because it sounds like this is it postmodern, or is this kind of post-postmodernism that's happening? I mean, if you know of Dom DeLillo, he wrote White Noise, and White Noise during
Yeah.
the mid-80s was kind of this joke about how things are doomed in like the 80s, where academics are thinking Plato has something to do with Bazooka Joe rappers, and DeLillo it's often called postmodern, but it's almost like a joke upon the people, the generation that Gen X or even post baby boomer. Now, like, there's now it seems to me that as baby boomers are going out of power, it's going to be Gen X and millennials to have some kind of influence. And so we have to ask whether we live in a post-postmodern era where there's something like a meta-narrative or even a meta-meta-narrative, where it seems to me that is it like bizarro fiction almost like no longer belongs to postmodernism, or is it some kind of strange child of postmodern, or is there a loyalty to that or something?
I think it's probably a little outside of that realm, just because I feel like a lot of Bizarro is very sincere. Bizarro originally, sort of the like core of Bizarro, formed right around the same time that that the Alt Lit movement, well before it was known as that. But when some of the writers first got active, like Noah Cicero wrote The Human War. And as a response to the Iraq War. And I feel like writers in both, while writing extremely absurd, often like very ridiculous fiction, it's also very sincere and very earnest. And I think that's one thing that really gives it a lot of strength.
Because I'm thinking about one of my friends showed me a House of Leaves by Marcin Danielewski, and that's kind of like a
Yeah.
strange fontist text where you have it's a pretty picture book, but the text, it's not read in a traditional way. It's all over the place like a painting, and that's often called as postmodernism. And so we have to question, is that a part of the postmodern legacy after DeLillo, or is this kind of a post-postmodernism happening where just nobody cares anymore, and as everyone's a modernist, you can pretty much call art whatever you want it to call, or something like that.
Yep.
For outside influence, do you know of Thomas Ligotti?
I do, yeah, I love his work.
Yeah, because it's funny because what I've been reading recently is mostly the books from Nine Banded Books. Tom Ligotti has a book on there called The Conspiracy of the Human Race. Nine Banded
Yeah.
Books is by Chip Smith. And he kind of publishes these kind of really semi-offensive book titles that's not in bizarro tradition. It's more like in the underground punk scene. It makes me think
Yeah.
of do you know of Jim Goad?
Yeah.
Okay, because Stark actually had him on the show a while back with Alex.
Well, he kind of when he had Answer Me, like he interviewed like all the most controversial people you can think of, like I think he even interviewed a Richard Ramirez.
Yes.
Huh, crazy.
But he did it in a
That's a
way where it was like a teen girl magazine where he pretended saying, "Well, how are you dating anyone right now?" And then he Ramirez says something really wacky, but it's funny. He's almost joking with it, but it's like it's strange because he wants you. It's this like almost like this Jerry Springer or Wally George type of punk thing. I don't know. It's interesting though that there's a scene of that. I think Nine Banded Books comes from that tradition.
Interesting. Yeah, that's a Thomas Ligotti. When I first started reading him, he had no books in print and had to pay quite a bit for everything on the secondary market. And it's been really amazing to watch just in the past couple of years, after the whole plagiarism controversy with True Detective. Penguin picked up and republished his first two collections. And his work just seems to be everywhere now. And I think for a short story of such uncompromisingly nihilistic short horror stories, like to break out like that is just great to see.
Are there specific like themes in the work, like say nihilism or alienation, or is it just
Yeah.
sort of a general absurdism?
So Thomas Ligotti is a Lovecraftian writer in a sense, but is also draws inspiration from E.M. Turan, who's like a post-Nietzschean philosopher, of books like A Brief History of Decay and The Trouble with Being Born. And like with Ligotti, you find some common tropes would be like puppets. Puppets appear in a lot of stories. But puppets almost reflecting like the vacancy and meaninglessness of humans. And basically everything is menacing in his story. While there are monsters at times, it's more like this monstrous awakening and realization that that nothing matters. And there's a streak of extremely dark humor running through his work as well, that can easily miss the first time just because it's so bleak. But then you realize it's almost a little bit funny at the same time.
And are those kind of themes in your work?
In mine? No, not necessarily. Thomas Ligotti is definitely an influence, but I don't really draw so much from that aspect of his work, except for the occasional short story here and there.
Can you talk about Lazy Fascist Press?
Yeah, so I've been running Lazy Fascist for, I think, 6 years now. And it's an imprint of Eraserhead Press focusing on more experimental, transgressive literary fiction, kind of forming a bridge between the world of like, other varieties of cult fiction and Bizarro, just the way that Eraserhead's horror imprint, Deadite, is kind of forming a bridge between
Eraserhead horror Press, and... Did they specialize in Bizarro?
Yeah, Eraserhead Press has been around for 15 years and publishes exclusively Bizarro.
It sounds like a title like Lazy Fascist Press, or even what we mentioned, Ask Goblins from Auschwitz, could actually target or be interested to somebody who's interested, I'll say this, on the alt-right on the internet, as if they're having this fetishization or fascination with far-right imagery. As if Bizarro fiction is playing with it, but it's not exactly that political ideology of alt-right, but is almost, not to say that's satirical or ironic, but it's this kind of strange mishmash of these things of shock art. And I've noticed, there's only two people I know in real life that know Bizarro fiction, and two of my friends I know are into punk and hardcore music, and they kind of read it for the offense factor. It seems to me, mm-hmm. with a name of, like, Lazy Fascist Press and Ash Goblins from Auschwitz would actually target the wrong audience of the alt-right. What do you have to say about that?
Yeah, that's, it's... Fortunately, we don't have very many followers who subscribe to the alt-right or identify with it at all. I would say that Bizarro is extremely far left as far as literary movements go. I think actually attack pretty much everything the alt-right stands for as often as possible. Often while, playing with some of the, appearing to, what you're saying there is like, it would seem to draw those people in and it doesn't though.
Liebach? And there's a classic Liebach documentary, and one of the first people to be in that documentary was Slavoj Zizek, and Zizek said that Liebach, though they are far right and they look like this evil band, is actually being subversive and doing quite the opposite through imagery. So it seems to me that you may be flirting with the lazy fascist name, but actually you mean quite the opposite, maybe.
Exactly. and I just feel like sometimes, especially when it comes to publishing, radical politics can be tricky because if the name and everything you do, doesn't challenge your own message, if you don't challenge your own beliefs at all, it's not helpful in the long run. And you're really only going to preach to the choir, people who already believe what you believe. And so the name is challenging and in a lot of ways uncomfortable. But I think it can also create conversations
would you say, this might sound a little funky and funny, Would you even say that maybe some of your work or some of Bizarro Fiction could fall under a term, quote-unquote, alt-left?
The term is tricky for me, but
have you
I mean,
heard of that term? It is kind of obscure.
Yeah, but yeah, a lot of Bizarro work is, addresses identity and gender politics, and more so than anything, Bizarro is about accepting everything and everyone, and so yeah, I could see it falling under that label.
In what sense, like in a sort of a nihilistic sense that anything goes and there's no moral limitations?
Not necessarily. That's the thing. There is with Bizarro, you do have a traditional sense of morality like you have in slasher films where, you know, young people are directly punished for their transgression. So that sort of morality is done away with in Bizarro. I think there's an extreme morality, like in the sense that, you could have a goldfish for a head and be considered a person with a heart, and dreams and desires, that there's nothing you can't be or can't transform into. Like one of the most popular Bizarro books is, House of Houses by Kevin L. Donaghy. And it's about a man who falls in love with his house and ends up being transported to a world of sentient houses where his house has a body and he's living in secret with his house. And basically this regime of houses forbids human house love, but secretly they elope and try to be together despite all odds. And I think there's the basic message there is that whatever you love and whoever you love is more important than anything else. So it's a bleak book, but the core message is positive, and reinforces tolerance and acceptance.
You know, I do like positive things like that, and make me think of some fiction I've read in the past where I felt like in the story of I didn't like the ending of the outcome of it. I have a really obscure book collection. There's this one strange pulp I read. It's called The Birth of Prudence by Ryan Andrews. And in that book, it's supposedly, I don't like the story at all, but I'll just say it real quick. It's about this kid who falls in love with this Asian girl, and everything's all great, but all of a sudden he becomes a white nationalist and dumps her. And I think, like, what the ending to that? I'm like, what? And then supposedly it's a tragedy. But obviously this book is published by VDare, which associates itself with other, you know, white nationalists and alt-right outlets. And I always thought that was a weird ending because, one, personally, I'm an Asian studies student, and I really liked the ideal that, you know, you can love someone no matter who it is. But in that terms, when it gets tricky in politics, it seems like you can literally transform any novel into some kind of political ideology and get it across, where I felt like I always like science fiction that, you know, is creative and fun and where everybody can relate to it. I find that, you know, like cyberpunk is almost similar to Tolkien's work, is because anybody, like if you read Tolkien, anybody can enjoy like The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings. It doesn't matter what background you're from. And
Pilliter, isn't there some whole kind of like political movement around like a cyberpunk?
I really like, the thing is, I think of cyberpunk as being enjoyable as anybody can really read it. I mean, it might have that postmodern edge that sounds super cliche, and I feel as though that anybody can wear a mohawk and hack into a computer and say that there's ice and
Could you even make the case that Akira is cyberpunk?
Oh yeah, I mean, I play this one collectible card game called Netrunner. It's basically a cyberpunk card game. It's just in the aesthetics of, you could really replace it with anything, but you fall in love with this aesthetic. And but yeah, it's definitely this late 80s, early 90s vaporwave thing with all this cyber stuff going on. And I'm just saying that the theme seems to be important, whatever you write. And it seems to me that you can attract someone, you know, on that background. You just have to be really good with it. And
yeah, I think if Bizarro started attracting a lot of people of the alt-right, we'd probably all, like, be, you know, wonder what we're doing wrong. I mean, and that's not to attack or offend anyone's personal beliefs, but we're seeing that pretty adamantly supports tolerance and acceptance of everyone on all levels. So, you know, to then appeal to a group that that is not entirely for tolerance and acceptance would be kind of a challenge.
Have you read any of the authors that are kind of I don't know if I want to, that are kind of associated with the alt-right, like Andy Nowicki, Anne Sterzinger, and a lot of, I guess, Nine Banded Books is sort of loosely affiliated with that.
No, I haven't, actually.
I was thinking, going back on music-wise, I was saying before that some of my friends, that, you know, they're into hardcore, and they like Bizarro Fiction. But do you know of, like, Boards of Canada, in a way?
Oh, yeah. Boards of Canada is great.
Yeah, like their new album, Tomorrow's Harvest, seems to be an album which is a throwback to some lost, obscure 1970s bad horror film with a synth soundtrack. Now, I know they're very popular. In fact, I think a news reporter on Fox said that his favorite band was Boards of Canada live on News TV. But it seems to be that people, we're now in a generation where we're, just to repeat this again, we're obsessed with this collector culture or nostalgia for the past, as if things possess some kind of spirit within it, where it's that people are looking for authenticity, and having possessions of things like
well, didn't one of our previous guests, I think, was it Dilworth, say that like art and inanimate objects in a sense possess a soul? I'm not sure if he meant that literally or abstractly, yeah. But that's what he said.
Yeah, that they. Dilworth said, John R. Dilworth said that, I don't want to take the words out, but he said that they possess a soul, and that people, like we were talking previously about anime and manga and how those things could possess a soul, and how Dilworth was calling it a cult, that people have a cult to the background, but, you know, always be skeptical of the controlling nature, but people love those things and follow them. And I think of Bizarro Fiction as that there is that a reflection of nostalgia. How much of the nostalgia factor is in Bizarro Fiction?
M.P. Johnson's Berserkoids is a fun collection that's kind of inspired by like a lot of like 80s cartoons and toys. And you do see a lot of nostalgia for that era in Bizarro. Absolutely. And a lot of the, books, or some of the books, read kind of like, you know, long lost weird cartoons from the 80s, and, you know, like things like or early 90s things like Street Sharks, and yeah. But
I have this one book, and it's I think it's called Cybernetrix or something. It looks like a Tron guy,
yeah,
on the front cover.
Cybernetrix by Carlton. Yeah, that's one of my favorites. That's,
I haven't
definitely
read it yet. I just got it, and it's on my I'm looking at it, but I haven't. I should read it.
Yeah, it's a good one. It's so yeah, I would say there's a fair amount of that. But the fun thing is, Bizarro, I feel, is always doing something a little bit new. So it's looking back into the past, but doing something a little stranger and a little wilder with it.
Like, one of your stories is about a character, he goes to, like, a birthday party in hell. I forget, what is that from Abortion Arcade?
That was from Die You Donut Bastards, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, birthday in hell.
It seems to me that also that as people are getting into this, you know, strange fiction, that seems to me most art online is happening like this. And talking about the internet, there's also, you know, internet memes like Pepe the Frog and Wojak, and like strange new internet things popping up every day. And people with internet programs, and as long as you have like maybe Photoshop or some video editing program, you could just upload it on YouTube and then get tons of subscribers and thousands. It's creating this strange art just like Vaporwave, where it's just cut up Muzak stuff. And it seems to me on that, where it could cross a fine line between culture, and maybe right now what's considered high art in his culture is just a mishmash of things together or something strange. Even in through politics, where it seems to be that now in politics you can be I'm gonna say this joking, like make I think you could be like a transhumanist, maybe lesbian vegetarian, you know. I'm just, not that there's such a thing, but it seems that we've now reached a point in possibility where identity politics has become almost an ideology in itself, that it seems that that now, like, me and Robert like to flirt with the ideal of an alt-left, where it's not alt-right, but an alternative left, where it doesn't even have any foundations yet. But so as long as you flirt with the ideal, maybe something will come out of it. And so, you know, it's almost like people now can make up their own
religion. So you're saying, Pillator, you're saying it's kind of like your concept of an alt-left is kind of like a fiction writing, in a sense, creating something from scratch that doesn't exist.
It's like there's a guy, Prince of Queens, and Ryan, they consider themselves alt-left, and yet they don't really have any – there's no, like, doctrine or there's no Bible. It's just things they like. They tag it and they attach it together. And then eventually, maybe in the next 2 or 3 years when everyone gets on it, eventually you might see a Wikipedia page called Alternative Left or something like that. And I want to bring up something, a little digression here. There was this guy named Chris Korda, and he had the Church of Euthanasia. And it was a strange kind of protest religion where people are better off dead and you shouldn't have babies. And Chris Korda is very controversial. He's like electronic musician and he basically says that the best way to live is be dead. He's not in it anymore, but it just shows you in the mid-90s, and he was advocating it and people were literally on it. He had signs that said feed a dead baby to Jesus or something like that.
Wait, did he actually like convince people to commit suicide?
I don't know, but at that time, Jack Kevorkian was real big, and he was pretty much on that bandwagon where people were getting upset about euthanasia and stuff. But it just shows you 20 years prior that there was already this weird fictional religion. I mean, it doesn't seem that there is a church of euthanasia now, but today it's exploded because of the internet and how you can make art on the internet and how maybe a meme magic or some kind of internet stuff creates these things all at once. It's almost like the ideal that Donald Trump was voted in as our U.S. president because he's a troll and everyone agreed upon it, but not based upon his politics, what he has to say. It's just no, because it offends everyone, and so as long as you believe it, he's there. And it's this strange era we're now in, and I feel as though that maybe in some sense bizarro fiction is a byproduct of how we see things and how we cut and paste things together.
Yeah, I mean, I think to a large degree it is. I think
fiction, at least. You know, what can bizarro fiction do for the greater good of people? You know, as you just said, that maybe there is tolerance, and maybe what kind of influence does it have to create, you know?
I think the most powerful thing bizarro can do is tell, you know, often it's going to be misfits and loners and people who don't know anyone else like them in their, you know, small shitty hometowns. Let them know that there are people like them out there who think like they do, and really that's how the bizarro scene has grown into what it is today. It's snowballed, and it's mostly people who don't really click elsewhere, and through that it's become a bunch of people like that who have a really tight-knit bond in a lot of ways over not fitting in anywhere else. And I think anytime, you know, fiction can, you know, make people feel like they're not alone, then it's achieving, you know, one of the basic goals of any sort of art.
It's interesting you brought up that theme of like loners and alienation, like those writers I mentioned earlier, like Andy Nowicki and Sterzinger write a lot about that theme. Do you have a lot of your characters in your books? Are they characters that are like loners and feel disconnected from society and they escape into like this kind of like fantasy world?
Yeah, that would describe a lot of the characters in all of my books. Yeah, pretty much runs through all of it.
And as interesting as like with Nowicki, he's coming at it. I mean, he's obviously like a social conservative Catholic, but that's always kind of the theme of his work. He focuses a lot on sexuality, and he sees sexuality as like a corrupting force. But his work is really dark. Like, if you're, I'd recommend like the Columbine Pilgrim, and what's the other one about? A lot of his stuff is kind of surreal.
I have Confessions of a Would-Be Wanker, and that's pretty much.
Well, that's philosophical. I'm thinking more of like his fiction work. I'm thinking.
The Columbine Pilgrim is basically about.
Well, there's Heart Killer, and then there's the one.
It's basically the loser has these revenge fantasies, and then he gets revenge upon everyone, and then he realizes that's kind of not a good way to live. It's almost moralist in a way, like Flannery O'Connor. I know that's an influence of his, and Andy Nowicki is even disliked also sometimes on the alt-right himself, which is really funny because that's even his fan base, and even the alt-right, huge alt-right, don't even, which I think is strange, and I think that's interesting that the writer always has, you know, this weird power. There's always conflict between who he's writing for and he himself. But yeah, that's an interesting thing to think about. I mean, do you like the Japanese writers like Yukio Mishima?
The work I'm familiar with. My favorite Japanese writer is actually Junji Ito, who's a manga writer, most popular for Uzumaki, but also Gyo, the Tomy series, a number of other shorter, weird, surreal horror works.
Yes, I noticed too. What's his name? I was looking in Bizarro Fiction. There was a Kenji Sieratori. He seems to write Bizarro Fiction with. I don't know. I think this was a collaboration with. I was looking at. I don't know if you know him, but I was just interested because I noticed that there's some Japanese actually interested in some of the avant-garde stuff. And like for me, I really like Yukio Mishima. That's kind of a classic. And as Robert was just saying, Nowicki is pretty much, I would argue, an American Mishima. It's the same morals of Mishima, just put it in a different context. I mean, some stuff really does come out of Asia, which seems to not be known in the Western world. And there's a lot of it happening. It just all depends if you get a really good translator and all the background between understanding Asian culture, between, you know, the Western culture we're always in. And so there's always a distance between that. But yeah, anime and manga seems to be a huge influence on our society. And I think it's,
Kalidor, can you think of a manga that best kind of fits in with Bizarro Fiction? I mean, I know the ones you mentioned a lot are, Pataliro and Akira.
Well, I like Pataliro. I mean, that's a old school yaoi, but, in my own Bizarro Fiction of Nana Song, I referenced Slam Dunk by Inoue. That's a basketball manga. I like the manga and the anime, and the anime is about 100 episodes long. And it's just basically the struggle of Sakuragi Hanamichi and his becoming a basketball player, learning to become, you know, social responsibilities, trying to fall for the girl. Very traditional. But at the same time, you know, you learn something through that it's not common for a Japanese to play basketball. Something you can put in these themes like that, but for Bizarro Fiction, I mean, from the absurdity of Attack on Titan to any, I don't want to be cliche, you know, like a tentacle porn hang tie or something like that. I mean, it's just depend. There's a lot to talk about on that. I don't know. What do you like, Cameron? Do you like anime?
Some. I don't watch a lot of anime, but it's a huge influence on Carlton Mellick. He's more recently his books are probably more inspired by manga and anime series than anything else. Fooly Cool is probably my favorite anime series, but I tend to like shorter narratives. So looking for an anime show to watch, I'm actually always looking for something that's not like, you know, 30 volumes long, and looking for something that's pretty self-contained and maybe, you know, just a couple episodes. So Fooly Cooly works really, really well for me.
With your work, does more of it take place like in this world or kind of like alternative universes or the future or like dreamscapes?
All of my earlier work took place in surreal, like otherworldly dreamscape type atmospheres. Now for the past couple of years, all of my work has been set in the real world or something very close to it, and the intrusions of the weird are subtler.
Do you see bizarro fiction themes in a lot of horror films? Like, could you make the case, like, for the Hellraiser series?
Yeah, you know, I mean, you definitely do see, well, I mean, splatterpunk was mentioned earlier, and John Skip, one of the founding fathers of splatterpunk, is now actively writing Bizarro and runs another imprint of Eraserhead, a really cool imprint called Fungasm. And definitely more horror writers from that era, too, have moved into Bizarro, like Robert Devereaux. Yeah, I do think you see a little of that there. At this point, you know, a canon of Bizarro films would mostly be back-labeling things that already exist, potentially existed, you know, without knowledge of the actual scene. But there are, I think that Bizarro's spreading its tentacles out there in a lot of unexpected places, and the influence definitely pops up.
Have you thought about like talking to some like indie directors and like making your work into films?
A couple of years ago, my wife and I were hired to write the pilot of an animated show called Space Fish, and you can actually watch the pilot episode on YouTube. There's definitely been film interest from a lot of different places for a number of different Bizarro works. Couple things have been optioned here and there by different authors, but at this point, nothing's gotten made except for some really, really cool short films, like When Sisera Stirs by Jeremy Robert Johnson, one of my absolutely favorite Bizarro short stories. That was adapted into a short film that's been making the festival circuit and actually winning a lot of awards. And I think budget, you know, is going to be one of the fundamental constraints of adapting a lot of Bizarro, that it's just it's too high concept to necessarily execute on a shoestring budget. But I think there are a lot of creative workarounds for that. And hopefully we will see more Bizarro films in the coming years.
I mean, I can't think of something off the top of my head, but I have seen like low budget films that are successful at kind of creating that like a surreal escape. A dreamscape.
Definitely. Yeah, and that's John Skip has been curating a short film series at BizarroCon for the past couple of years, mostly short films and music videos, but there's some really, really cool stuff that's been getting made. So I do expect to see some feature length Bizarro films in the next couple of years. But yeah, at this point, mostly short films.
Are you do you ever do art with painting or with drawing? Because I draw all the time. I just never really upload the stuff. I did do digital stuff, but I feel as though that if you have this kind of mind frame, instead of just, you know, typing on the keyword, because, you know, I learned it from school, that's what you do, you know, you type on a key. It seems like outside you can do art. Are you much of a painter or cartoonist or?
When I'm stuck on stories, I often draw crude cartoons. In fact, the drawer on my desk is just filled with a bunch of those right now. And so I did a number of illustrations, just like simple line drawing creatures for Diudonut Bastards. But outside of that, no, anytime I'm doing that sort of thing, I do it for myself, or I do it to kind of work through creative blocks that I'm having on whatever I'm working on.
Because I'm torn between being a writer or an artist, yet I don't have time for art, so I'm in front of a keyboard all the time, and I'll be ended up typing the things I see rather than actually drawing, and I feel as though that it's almost hard to get into. I mean, you could just draw in a notebook, but it seems to me, you know, if you had like a digital pad, you could just do these Tumblr cartoons on the internet or even get into Flash. I used to be into that, and just start uploading art online if you're really good at it, but I feel as though that writing gives the ability of just, you know, it's easier to write something than to actually physically draw it.
I have kind of the opposite issue. I've been painting a long time, but I'm just starting to like dabble in writing.
Yeah, I feel most comfortable working with words by far. I can use words to convey whatever it is I'm attempting to, or at least I can try to. with images, I feel a lot more limited, and that's not, that's only my own limitations, that, that my skill set in terms of illustration is pretty much exclusively limited to crude, weird creatures, that say weird things. And I have fun doing that, for my own personal amusement, but yeah, it's not something that I necessarily share. It's more just stuff that goes into my desk drawer and gets lost.
When people read your work, do you think it's sort of necessary to have like a aesthetic image in their head of what they're seeing? Or would you rather just kind of let the words bring people to kind of stimulate their imagination and create their own image?
You know, it's when I read, I often don't have clear images of characters or settings, that I tend to envision it more abstractly. And a lot of my books have been described or often described in reviews as being extremely vivid, which is kind of funny because I'm not necessarily picturing them, in that sense. But mostly just working to execute all action and movement clearly and logically, and sometimes, you know, acting out scenes when possible to ensure that things happen naturally. I'm kind of always just making an effort to ensure that, I don't know, there's kind of a sense of naturalism there, because I feel like to effectively pull off any sort of weird, surreal stuff, the more natural it seems, the more convinced the reader will be.
Yeah, I mean, when I read your work, I have many images in my head, but I always feel as though there's that one image where, you know, if you read horror, you think of the most horrible thing you can, but if you read romance, you think of the most beautiful thing. I mean, I really like romance, and what I'm writing right now is... I'm trying to publish one of my own, self-publish a book about just romance stories I've had in my past 6 years of my life, and just trying to put that on paper because I find it almost meaningful, where, you know, it seems to me that, you know, writing does have that reflection of, you know, the writer itself, but you get also connected to emotion. And I find that, depending, you know, people will go after aesthetics, right? People watch Vaporwave because they want to be reminded of their early childhood with video games and anime, you know, so they will. And if they, you know, people want to read bizarre fiction because whatever reasons, from monsters to outrageous things to new ideals, or they actually find comfortable reading for the first time, you know, it's there. And I always feel like the way genre is, you know, art is going to go is through whether people feel a certain aesthetic from it. It's the reason why I read a lot of manga is simply because or even shoujo manga, is because I love the romance between that. I love the aesthetic of falling in love at a youthful age over and over again. It's this kind of strange thing about the human, you know, person. It's something beautiful too, and I think that it's grand art can do that.
Yeah, I'd agree.
We are getting close to the end of the show. Can you talk about some of your upcoming projects?
Yeah, so we just released the latest Lazy Fascist Press releases. That's Star Creek by Nathan Carson. It's a weird fiction novel set in rural Oregon in 1986. A little similar to Stranger Things, if you liked that. And we talked a little about nostalgia in Bizarro. And that's definitely kind of a nostalgic, retro, weird novel. I'll be going to Portland tomorrow for the release of Star Creek at Fowls on Hawthorne. And we also released Glue by Constance Ann Fitzgerald, which is a meditation on grief and death. And we also released Rumbullion by Molly Tanzer, which originally appeared as a limited hardcover, and now we're releasing it in paperback for the first time. For my own work, my most recent book is Taut Lines. It's a nonfiction anthology of fishing essays by a variety of writers, some in the Bizarro scene, but also people like Jeremy Wade of River Monsters. And yeah, it's quite a bit of a departure from a lot of my work, but been doing more fishing writing in the past couple of years, in addition to Bizarro. My next book will be a weird noir novel called Bad Luck Lullaby, about a recovering addict who meets a woman in trouble, and upon running out of town with her, they become entrapped by a mollusk worshipping cult.
And Pillator, do you want to? Before I wrap up, do you want to ask another question?
Yes. Do you like fishing? I was just thinking about fishing. Are you a fisherman yourself, or are you just fascinated with fishing? That's kind of.
I am. I fish all the time, actually, and it's definitely one of the things that motivated me to move out to the Oregon coast.
Because that's kind of funny. I've never really fished in my life, but certainly a hobby can definitely influence behavior. I mean, I like playing board games, and it's something I like to do, and maybe I'll write a fictional story about playing strange board games. Who knows?
Yeah, you could. You definitely could. That's the thing. I fish, and it's like, you know, I should probably write about this and kind of then make it sort of work and a tax write-off. So that's what I've done.
There's this story out of Japan. This is kind of absurdist, where they like froze like thousands of fish into like this ice skating rink.
I did hear about that.
And they all died, and they had to clean up the pool. I heard of this too, and it's kind of sad, but they did do a chant at the end. They gave it a kind of, the fish are in somewhere else, but they got it clear.
Yeah, I did hear about that. It seemed like that'd be kind of a mess, that, you know, using fake fish would have created the same effect, without all the mess and killing 5,000 fish. But, you know, I guess they tried for something different. So.
What part, I mean, I'm in California. What part of California did you grow up in?
Grew up in Bakersfield and then moved out to San Luis Obispo after that.
Okay, so I'm in Santa Barbara, so I'm pretty close to San Luis Obispo.
Yeah, really close.
Have you been to the Madonna Inn? I've been working on a series of paintings of the interior there.
Yeah, I have been there many times.
Then also, I briefly lived in Fresno.
Yeah, that's a... Yeah, last time I was in Santa Barbara was for a Leftover Crack show, actually. That was, I want to say that was probably 2006 when I was there last.
Okay. And then, yeah, I pretty much, I grew up in L.A.
There's actually a big bizarro scene developing in Los Angeles now as well. Really cool, like, dark, offbeat. Art gallery, Hyena Gallery in Burbank, has hosted a number of bizarro events and is always a fun spot to hang out at for weird art.
So it's not just a literature. There's a whole like subset of as you mentioned, like illustrators and painters as well.
Yeah, more and more all the time. Musicians as well.
We are at the end of the show. Cameron Pierce, it's been an excellent show. Thanks for being on.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It was great talking to you guys.
Also, thanks, Pillator.
Thanks for having me on the show, Robert. And it's wonderful you can be on, Cameron Pierce.
Yeah, thank you. All right, have a good night, guys.